Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. You can find out more about the festival and all Bookmarks events and programs at www.bookmarksnc.org. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett. And today's episode was recorded live in front of an audience at Bookmark's beautiful community gathering space and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Christopher Swan, whose debut novel, Shadow of the Lions, was published last week by Algonquin Books. Chris is an award-winning writer of short fiction who holds a PhD in creative writing from Georgia State University. He lives with his wife and two sons in Atlanta, where he's the chairman of the English department at Holy Innocents Episcopal School. Chris, welcome to Inside the Writer Studio.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you all for being here.
So I skipped over a fairly significant portion of your biography that I think we're going to spend a lot of time talking about today. The Shadow of the Lions is set in a fictional boarding school called Blackburn, but you drew pretty heavily on a school that not only you and I, but I think a lot of members of our audience attended. So tell us a little bit about your boarding school experience.
I think you're talking about Woodbury Forest.
Yes,
I went there all 4 years. I actually grew up, as a child, I lived here. From like age 7 or 8 to 16, but I went off to Woodbury in third form, ninth grade. And after the first 6 weeks, where everybody just sort of cries themselves to sleep at night, or at least I did, and then we're so busy, and then we make friends, and then it's just school. I loved it. I loved the experience there, and it's, my wife, I'd worked in a different novel for many years. You know, imagine a really bad ripoff of Pat Conroy trying to write something that has the IRA in it. It didn't make any sense. And right, it did to me, but after about the eighth or ninth time of reading it, my wife Kathy, bless her heart, said, not unkindly, why don't you try writing something you know? And I said, I'm a white middle-aged southern man who went to boarding school, like what? And she said, you don't have to write about you, but write about, you know, boarding school, why don't you write a story set there? And I resisted it for a little while because there's so many good stories set in those settings, and I was scared. I said it was because I was afraid, I thought it would be boring, but once I kind of got over myself and thought about it, it was a whole lot of fun. I've said before, I took all the best parts of Woodbury and I put them in this book, and all the bad parts of Blackburn I made up completely. So
the book is set in a, I guess we could say, a fictionalized Woodbury Forest, but it's certainly, there are things that if you are familiar with Woodbury will certainly ring true to you. But there's a lot more to it than that. There's more than just setting. There's characters and story. Give us the elevator pitch. Tell us what the book is about.
Two boys who were roommates at a Virginia boarding school, very close, best friends, get into an argument near the end of their senior year. Matthias has betrayed his friend Fritz, and Fritz runs off from him into the woods that are around the school. Matthias chases after him, can't find him, says, fine, I'll find him after dinner, I'll make it up to him. He doesn't find him after dinner. Nobody finds him after dinner. Police, FBI, nothing. Fritz is gone. Almost 10 years later, Matthias comes back to the school, takes a teaching job. His life's kind of fallen apart, but he's trying to get back on track. And he learns a couple things about his missing friend, so he decides to dig. The story goes from there.
Okay. Would you like to read us an excerpt?
Sure. The two lions crouched on top of their pedestals, frozen in preparation to leap. One was snarling, its stone teeth menacing in the late afternoon shadows, while the other stared out with disdain at the broad sweep of empty soybean fields that lay just across the state highway, a disdain made all the more pointed because the lion was missing its left eye. The missing eye was their only major flaw, a myth of swift and terrible justice falling on those who harmed the lions had shielded them from further disfigurement over the years. Blackburn legend had it that the student who chiseled out the left eye as a class prank in 1947 died that same week, drowning in the Shenandoah Creek when his canoe tipped over. Since then, the lions have been revered by the students, and although time had worn away at these guardians of Blackburn's front entrance, the lions remained fixed to the spot where they had sat for more than a century. The columns of Raleigh Hall, the freshman dorm, might be painted pink. A faculty member's car might be placed inside the dining hall in the dead of night. The headmaster might open his office one morning to find every square inch filled with balloons. But the lions were left alone. Jogging in place to keep from cooling down, I stared up at the lions, breath issuing from my open mouth like steam. It was a half mile back to the track, and the temperature was unusually cold for the middle of March. I didn't want to cramp up. But I didn't leave either. Just jogged in place and tried through sheer willpower to lower my heart rate and slow my breathing. Running from the track to the school gate and back was a typical warm-up, but I was alone. My teammates were running in the opposite direction to the old closed bridge over the Shenandoah. I had asked Coach Meyer if I could run to the gate, knowing he would say yes. I was a team captain and a senior. He had every reason to trust me. So when he nodded absently at me, I ran hard, sprinting away from the track and putting distance between myself and my team. Living in Blackburn, in close quarters with 400 other boys in the Virginia countryside, could be claustrophobic. But that wasn't why I'd run away from the others, feet pounding the road even after I'd reached the broad belt of trees that surrounded Blackburn's campus like a forest wall. My father had told me the previous fall at the annual Blackburn-Manassas prep game that in times of crisis, a man's instinct is to do one of two things: retreat to a place of safety, or gather up his strength and hurl himself headlong into the fray. Looking from one lion to the other while I ran as if on an invisible treadmill, I did not know whether I was retreating to a place of safety to lick my wounds, or trying to gather myself together before heading back to school and facing what I had done. The Blackburn School, like most boarding schools in America, has its own fiercely held traditions. Some are idiosyncratic, like the bonfire torches that freshmen, third formers in Blackburn parlance, must construct out of burlap, wire, and 2x4s. Others are born out of a fundamental belief in certain core principles, a belief that borders on fervor. The honor code at Blackburn is rooted in such a belief. Its rules are stark as barbed wire against snow. You will not lie, or cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. The punishment for being found guilty of violating the honor code is expulsion. And I had violated the code.
As somebody who was not only a Woodbury student, but a cross-country runner, you had me in the first paragraph. You know. And again, I think
Thanks. People
who are familiar with Woodbury will recognize some of those details, like the torches and of course, the honor code, which I want to talk a little bit more about later.
Sure.
But I want to get into the balancing act that you have to do when you know that some of your readers are going to be intimately familiar with the world that you're writing about. And to some of them, it's going to be as strange as a world in a science fiction novel. How do you keep it interesting for the people who already know what boarding school life is like, while at the same time making it accessible to readers for whom that's a foreign thing?
That's a good question. I had conversations like that with my editors at Algonquin, because trying to go into too much technical detail about how an honor code works, an explanation of it is, well, it's going to be boring. Unless it's in the service of story. So I tried to limit that as much as possible, just sort of show it and show the reactions of people to a situation where they could violate the honor code or they might not. Because most people get right and wrong. If I wanted to clearly set up, in this world, it is very wrong to do any of these things to the point where they will kick you out. And there are scenes that flash back to Matthias, the main character, talking when he first gets to school and he learns about the honor code. And his immediate reaction is he thinks of it as yet one more reason I can get kicked out of school. Like, he's not sure what to make of it and comes to understand, well, they believe in this here, okay. It was kind of like scenes that have to do with teaching, because those are, I wrote some of those in here and I've taught for many, many years. And those can be boring to read. unless there's something going on with the characters, you learn something or somehow furthers the story. Teaching isn't boring. I don't think learning's boring, but I think that unless something else is going on, kind of like with the honor code stuff, if you're not explaining it, like I wanted to set up, and I screwed up and I'd broken the code. I like characters who make mistakes. They're fun to write about.
Well, on the subject of teaching, mm-hmm. you do something that I haven't seen before in boarding school novels. I haven't read all of them, but we have parts of the novel that are told from the point of view of a student and parts of the novel that are told from the point of view of a teacher, and that's the same person.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting device, but how did you get into sort of the both of those minds? I mean, you've been a student and a teacher, but you're looking at it from these two different points of view.
I'd always had an idea of writing a story about somebody going back to their high school as a teacher, or going back to a college. I wasn't sure what. Pretty soon it narrowed it down to high school, but had some kind of guilt or secret past or something. They were dragging. I couldn't make it work. I came up with the idea in college, and I couldn't make it work and kind of just shelved it. And then when I came back to it many years later, I was writing all about him as an adult, and I found myself he was explaining or describing things that had happened to him as a kid, and it was just really clunky. So I thought, end chapter, next one. Here he is now, he's a third former, he's a senior. And that just seemed to work. The main mystery at the heart of this is what happens to his friend Fritz, who disappears. And I had to show what his relationship was like with this guy beforehand, so that him vanishing would mean something. That it would, you know, that maybe readers would miss him too, or want to know what happened to him. So to me, it was sort of organic. It came out of, but I tried different things that were just sort of clunky, and so this just worked. It was fun. It was fun to toggle back and forth.
I felt like it worked well. It's an interesting way to look at the arc of a character, to be able to really be in that character as a teenager, mm-hmm. and then be in that character as an adult, and then we kind of get to infer some of what has happened in between to get him from one place to the other. So for those of you who were in the class of 1988, if there's anybody here from that class, my brother was actually in Swanee's class. I'm told I'm supposed to call you Swanee. There's a great bit in the book about nicknames, and so I had to find out what Chris's nickname was.
That was mine.
But there, you do have a lot of what we call in the business Easter eggs. We have a couple of Winston-Salem natives whose last names turn up as the chaplain is somebody named Joyner. The football coach is somebody named Christina. I started seeing all these names, and I thought, I know
both classmates
people.
Of mine, yeah.
How do you have fun with those Easter eggs, but without letting that sort of take over what you're doing?
When my wife said, write what you know, I resisted that for, I was like, I want to make up everything. But then when I started going into the story, I realized I can still make up stuff, but I can take things. Some of it was sort of an inside joke. It was just sort of fun for me. I literally took a list of first names and a list of last names of my classmates. And, I mean, I didn't cut them out and jumble them up, but I made sure to mix them up and put them in the book and do it in a way that I certainly didn't want to be malicious. Like, all the people who are doing bad things or characters you don't like, they don't bear any intentional resemblance to anybody in real life. I didn't want someone coming back and going, thanks a lot, put my name in your book, man. You know, my roommate for 3 years, Matthew, his first name's Daryl, and so he was like, I'm in the book, aren't I? I'm like, oh yeah, you're totally in the book, and he read it. And so it was, he didn't go missing. He's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. But no, it was fun doing that, but I tried to be aware. It's like any kind of joke. You want it to be, I mean, you don't want it to be hurtful or someone to feel like they were left out or whatever. But it was a fun way to kind of look at my own past and take stuff I knew and put it in places that would make sense.
Well, I think what you said earlier about doing things in service to story, people asked me, where do you get your names from? Well, you had a Woodbury Forest yearbook to get your names from. That's
I've got it.
It's not easy coming up with names.
No.
Did you know when you were at Woodbury that you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, I knew since 8th grade. Mrs. Corpening, who taught me at Wiley Junior High, here in Winston-Salem, we were about to do the Revolutionary War unit. And, you know, at the end of this, there will be a project, she announced. And we all knew what that meant. The girls were going to make calico dolls, and the guys were going to write a book report in Johnny Tremaine, or we were going to make a poster diagramming the musket and how it works. This is what had happened forever. But she had she said, we have some new choices. She had this, you remember mimeographed sheets, you know, the purple, right? So she handed this out, and halfway down was this assignment that said, you can write a diary, or for the boys, a journal, of a fictitious person living in the Revolutionary War era. You couldn't write from Ben Franklin's point of view or Betsy Ross. You had to make up your own character. And I thought, I'm doing that. And my friends thought I was insane. They're like, do the poster thing, man. I'm like, I don't care about a musket. Everyone's going to do it. I don't want to be the fifth kid to get up and go, so here's the... So I was able to, I had to do a little research on the Revolutionary War battle at Kings Mountain, and I, you know, which meant I read the World Book Encyclopedia article about it and made everything else up, and I thought, I want to do this. And Ted Blaine at Woodbury, you know, mentored me, and, you know, he wrote a novel, got published after we graduated, called Passion Play, and he had us write some creative have some creative short pieces, and I knew I wanted to do it, but I also wasn't sure, like, what am I going to do for a living? Because even then, I had this sense that I'm not just going to be able to, I'll just write a book, and I'll just live for it. What do most writers do? And I'd look at a lot of them were teachers and professors, and I thought, okay, I'll do that. I mean, that's about the depth of my thought. Here's what my career will be, and now I'm going into my 22nd year of teaching at Holy Innocence. So, but no, I've wanted to write. I've wanted to write since eighth grade, and it took a while, but yeah, here we are.
We have a very dear friend in England who, when my first novel came out, she described me as the man who takes 20 years to become an overnight success. Welcome to the club.
Thanks. Yeah, I was worried it would be like Mr. Holland's Opus, so that would be, you know, retiring, and I'd still be working the same novel.
Let's talk a little bit about why you chose to go to Woodbury, and in particularly this idea of single-sex education. So we have here in Winston-Salem, Salem Academy, where our daughters can go, and I had only daughters, so that was a great option for them. But if we have sons here in Winston-Salem, including some sons here in the audience tonight, and they want to have a single-sex education, Woodbury is about their closest option. What are your feelings on, both as a teacher and as a graduate of a school that was all boys, on single-sex education?
I loved it for myself. My father was a banker with Wachovia, and he went to boarding school, went to Christ School in Asheville, and my mom went to St. Catherine's, Virginia. And they didn't tell me this at the time, but I think they knew that Dad might end up getting transferred somewhere else in North Carolina at some point. And so I think they didn't want me to start high school one place and then maybe end up in another. They didn't know that for sure, but they thought that might happen, which is exactly what did happen, that we did move. And so we were looking at different schools, and Woodbury, I liked Woodbury the best, and I was fortunate enough to get in. Where I teach, it's co-ed day schools, the largest Episcopal day school in the country. And it's still, to me, kind of unique. I mean, I've taught there for a long time. Like, we didn't have girls in class. You know, we didn't have prom. We didn't have a spring formal, right, which is a whole lot of fun. But that was like a one-off, or they had not really had one when I was at Woodbury. But in ninth grade English classes, and our middle school English classes, they teach them separated by gender. There's some research 10, 15 years ago that this was beneficial, especially for boys. Of course, since then, there's been some other research that says actually it's sort of a wash, it might not be. But anecdotally, from my experience, it is good. It's artificial, because it's only for one class, and they go back to, you know, co-ed classes in science and math and so on. But I've found it, I do have to think differently, and I can approach issues differently and talk differently with young women in ways than I do with young men. And now I'm old enough to be their father now, so it was a little strange being, say, 25 and teaching and having some 17-year-olds in the class. But I think it's unique. I think that ninth grade boys and ninth grade girls, you have them together in a class. This is a very general statement, and this is almost stereotypical. But the girls are far more mature. I had a class where before we did single sex. We were talking about a story, and this girl was talking about the symbolism in the tree in the story, and one of the ninth grade boys was literally like hiding. He got up from his chair and started hiding behind this fake tree I had off in the corner, which we'd use for plays and such in class, and it was just acting like, I'm like, what are you doing? You know, sit down, George. And the girls are all rolling their eyes, going, oh my God. And most of the time, the boys were doing that because they were either trying to get the girls' attention or they were uncomfortable and didn't know what to do, so they acted. I vaguely remember being a 14-year-old boy, so I got it. And that's gone when it's just all boys.
I think the other dynamic to me that's at work at a school like Woodbury, and not only being a boarding school where everybody lives together all the time, but also just the geographic isolation.
Yes.
Which I guess for you was even more than it was for me if the bridge was gone by the time, or was closed by the time you came along. We used to be able to go across the bridge.
No, it was open. They closed it. I think they closed it during my time there, but I remember when we first went there, we did go over the bridge, but at some point pretty quick, yeah, they closed it.
For those of you who aren't familiar, Woodbury is a rural campus in central Virginia that's, you know, a pretty good ways from anything. And so it creates a very insular, isolated community, but I think that provides some interesting opportunities. So one of the things that happens, I don't think this is giving away too much in your novel, one of the things that happens is there's a death on campus. And I had that experience when I was at Woodbury of a teacher who died when we were in session.
Okay.
And it's a very powerful experience to go through in such a small community. And I wonder if you could talk about whether you had any experiences like that yourself at Woodbury, but also how you sort of showed the way that rocked the community in the book.
When I was a senior, a sixth former, a girl who lived in Charlottesville, parents are good friends of my parents, died in a car accident. And I wasn't especially close with this girl, but she was always real friendly to me. When we'd go to Charlottesville, my parents normally get together with this girl's parents, and she'd like, oh, hey, Chris, come, let me introduce some of my friends. We watch a movie. And if you're in an all-male boarding school, and this nice girl is like, hey, come meet some of my friends, you say yes. And she always treated me very kindly. And then I got news that she died. And I wasn't secretly in love with her or anything like that, but she was the first person my age, in my age group cohort, that I had known who had died. And it gutted me, and I didn't understand why. I mean, I understood, you know, I felt awful and sad, but I didn't understand why it hurt so much because, well, you know, you're 17, you're immortal. You know that you're not really, but you're like, but really I am. Like, bad things happen to other people, that kind of thing. And without knowing it, I didn't even think about that until after I'd written that part of the book, long after. But I kind of drew on that memory of just being, and my roommate at the time at Woodbury was on the Woodbury in Britain program. Usually you would talk to your roommate if you were close with them, you would share like about everything. Well, at the moment I didn't have anybody to talk to. And I just remember how much it hurt. I think that the enclosed nature of a school like Blackburn in here is a lot of fun for a writer because they are kind of trapped. And they can't just go home. And the book is set before the predominance, it's 21st century, but set before predominance of cell phones and all that kind of stuff. So it was still kind of what it was like for me in the 1980s going to boarding school. You didn't have social media, you didn't have all that. So I tried to play with that. And so it fosters this kind of intense atmosphere where something like that happens. You know, we've experienced at the school where I work in Atlanta, we've experienced death. And we're wonderful as a community to come together, but then everybody goes home at the end of the day, and there's a support system there, and at school, well, you can't go home. You are home in a school like this. So from a writing standpoint, it was a lot of fun to play with that, and I tried to get a lot of dramatic tension out of it, and I hope I did.
Yeah, I think it works well. I think the combination of adolescence and that insular community that is, like you say, that is together 24 hours a day, which is kind of an artificial thing if you think about it.
Yeah, it is.
And even now, as you point out, it doesn't exist anymore with cell phones and everything. But I think that combination sort of magnifies emotions and magnifies the importance of maybe, I mean, obviously death is important, but even of events that might seem less important.
Yeah.
Telling a lie, you know.
Right.
It magnifies it, which makes, I think, for good reading and for exciting writing.
I hope so. And I think that's part of when you were talking about earlier, asking me about the honor code, how do you get that across to people who go, really? They didn't lie, you know, they lie and they kick them out? What is that? Well, if you read, you know, you're reading in this book, hopefully in the world in the book, it's intensified. Everything is intensified and everything is, this is a big deal. It is an insular community. But, you know, I tried to honor the good parts of that. And I exploited other parts of it in the interest of the story.
I think a lot about, you know, people who are writing science fiction or fantasy use this term world building.
Yeah.
And essentially what somebody who creates a boarding school in the middle of the Virginia countryside is doing is world building. You're setting up a set of rules and processes by which a community agrees to function. And I think you did a nice job of sort of
thanks
doing that same kind of world building.
Well, in the history, I mean, the history of Woodbury, you know, what I remember, I don't remember dates real well, but it was a post-Civil War. Okay, we are going to create this community. There's no school in the nearby area. And so we are going to create, they literally created a world. And then it grew into, now it's a school for young men, and it's gone from there, and it's still going strong. So they're doing something right.
I've been back a couple of times in the last 2 or 3 years at the invitation of Ted Blaine, because for a while the 10th formers were reading one of my books, and I was really impressed by, especially by the quality of the students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they're way smarter than I was when I was there. And, you know, just nice young men, which is nice to see. So The Shadow of the Lions is, I don't like to use the word genre, because this certainly is not a genre novel, but it does fit into this history of boarding school novels, which have been popular both in the United Kingdom and in the United States. Did you read some of the classic boarding school novels when you were getting ready to write this book, or did you have...
No, deliberately not. Somebody pointed out early on when I was writing this, I'm like, oh, like a separate piece. And I was like, well, damn it. You know, I'd forgotten that one. And I deliberately did not want to, because I'm like, yeah, and it's two friends, and oh, damn it. But I deliberately did not go back and reread that at that point. But yeah, I've read, you know, and I've taught The Catcher in the Rye. But it's funny, because students now, if I mention boarding school to my current students, especially younger ones, there's a handful that go, oh, I know Woodbury Forest and schools like that. My cousin goes there or whatever. But for many students today, you know, when we used to teach Catch on the Rye, they're like, oh, you know, Holden needs Prozac and a hug. Like, why are the parents shipping him off to this? Yeah. What is this horrible? Because to them, it's either therapeutic boarding school or it's rehab. And I'm like, no, I mean, those exist, and they're needed, especially therapeutic, but it's a nice private school. You just happen to live there. It's not a punishment.
Right.
I mean, even when I went there, when I came back home, people asked me where I went. I said, I go to boarding school. They would all look at my hair. I'm like, what are you doing? They were looking to see if it was shaved, because they thought military. I'm like, it's not, no. But the tradition of boarding schools and novels and in movies, Dead Poets Society, right, School Ties and the movies like that. I was a little intimidated at first trying to write a story set in that world, because it's been done. But I found it to be this sort of this rich environment and the friendships and the relationships. And what would it be like if your best friend, because you know, you make your friends that you make when you're a child, a teenager, those are really deep and powerful ones. What would happen if your best friend, you got in an argument with your best friend, you've done something wrong to him, he runs away, and then he's gone, no one ever sees him again. How would that affect you? I thought I came up with that, and I was sitting smiling, I could be like, this could be good. I might screw this up, but this is gonna be good, I think. And yes, you can have deep friendships with people without going to boarding school, but it's a unique environment.
Yeah.
So what would that be like? What kind of a shadow would that cast over your whole life?
You know, you said a couple of things there I think every writer has experienced. One is the cold, sweated fear that what we're doing has already been done before.
Right.
We get that with just about every sentence.
Mm.
But then also that delight that you have when you come up with a what if that seems latent with potential. Which is kind of what we're always looking for. So you mentioned a separate piece, and I can remember reading a separate piece when my brother was at Exeter, and it was no secret that a separate piece was set at Exeter.
Yep.
Just as I think it's no secret that this book is certainly inspired by...
Well, it's not a secret now, apparently.
It
never was.
You know, when I was at Woodbury, one of the questions that I got from the boys on more than one occasion was, are you going to write a book about Woodbury Forest? And now I can say, well, it's already been done. But what kind of response have you gotten from the Woodbury community?
I was in Raleigh last night at another bookstore doing a reading, and six of my classmates showed up. five of them I have not seen since graduation, which was a while ago. And the beauty of social media. I mean, one of them flew up from Tampa. His parents live in the Raleigh area, so he had another excuse. But that's been wonderful. I got a wonderful note from Byron Halsey, the head, who was a student 2 years ahead of me at Woodbury. Ted Blaine, we keep referring to him. He was just this revered English teacher at Woodbury. And I sent this long and rather effusive email to all these different teachers. Once I found out my book had sold, to all my teachers and creative writing folks, and he was one of them, and his response was just glorious. He was so happy for me, and they posted something online on the school website this past week. It's been great. My 30th high school reunion is this coming spring. I'm planning to go up for this one, it's going to be fun to go back and see.
I found that in general, and I'm sure you'll find this too, that people appeared out of my past. But several Woodbury reconnections that I made when my first novel came out. My cross-country coach mm-hmm. mailed me out of the blue. I hadn't had any contact with him in probably 30 years, and we mm-hmm. had a nice correspondence. One of my choir director emailed me. One of my teachers showed up at the Virginia Festival of the Book, and I'm sitting on a panel just getting ready to start, and I hear behind me, "Psst, hey, love it!" And I turn around, and there's this Woodbury teacher. So it's nice to have that kind of community support.
Yeah.
So what do you have your students read?
I teach mostly 12th graders, AP English Lit, and let me think. Beowulf, Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Moby Dick, yes, Moby Dick, Candide, Jane Eyre. Freshmen, I'm going to be teaching freshmen again this for the first time in 4 years this year as well. Heavy writing class. We do Romeo and Juliet, a lot of short stories, much more variety of shorter texts. The AP one I've sort of set, because I'm the AP English Lit teacher, so I've sort of set that. And every once in a while I rotate something up. Oh, Frankenstein too. I forgot Frankenstein. Yeah, it's fun.
Will, do you think your students will read this book?
Some of them have. My launch party was at Holy Innocence. They offered to host it, which was incredibly kind and generous of them. And a lot of former students showed up. In fact, most of the places I've gone on my tour so far, I haven't been many, but just about everywhere a former student has shown up, someone with Woodbury. Yeah, it's been really great. At my book launch party, there were students who were still there who bought a copy and said, "Sign my book, Dr. Swan." I'm like, this is the most pleasantly bizarre and surreal thing that has ever happened to me. I'm not going to require them to read it, but we'll see.
That's great. We had a similar experience when my first novel came out. We were retiring from a position, my wife and I both at school, and we went straight from the celebration that our theater colleagues and students did on the occasion of our retirement, and then we went outside and got a drink of water and went back into the auditorium, and it was the launch party for my novels. It was just totally surreal.
That's awesome.
So we're going to do something here on Inside the Writer's Studio, and you're the first one to do this, so hold your breath. We're going to ask you 10 questions. These are rapid-fire, short-answer questions. They will not be graded.
I won't be bad at the short-answer part already.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
But just to kind of get a read on you and some of your thoughts about reading and writing. So here we go. Number one, what word do you love to work into your writing?
Misty.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Moist.
Where's your favorite place to write?
Anywhere I can carry my laptop.
Where could you never write?
In my classroom.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
Sentence fragments.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Babar.
What are you reading now?
The Alice Network by Kate Quinn.
What book would you like to have written?
The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
That's a great question. You mentioned sci-fi and fantasy and world building, and if I could write a really good, what's the old term, crackerjack version, one of those, I probably would.
And the last question of what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
So smart aleck in me is like, I just purchased your book, or 10. My book came out August 1st, but Amazon shipped it out early. And so I had all these people before then come who were reaching out to me saying, I loved your book. It's, I love the story. And it's, you know, that's the coolest gift you can get. So
we have a few minutes to take questions from the audience.
Oh, please.
If we have some.
How long did you write short stories before you tackled the novel?
I love short stories. I don't love writing them because I felt like I was really bad at endings. That's why I wanted to write a novel. I don't have to end it for 400 pages. But I went to in graduate school in English and creative writing at Missouri, and so we did a lot of writing short fiction. And I wrote some I'm pretty proud of, but there's an art to that that's different from writing a long piece. I think when I was younger too, I thought, well, short stories are just sort of practice for the real thing. And then I started doing it and realized, no, this is its own complete different art form, and I am maybe competent at it, but I'm at short stories, but I think I'm going to be more comfortable doing something longer. So it a few years, but it just I was always interested in writing a longer piece. And my short stories started getting longer and longer in class, too.
It's funny that you asked that question, because there's actually a Woodbury graduate in the audience tonight who emailed me a few days ago telling me that he would like me to submit some short stories to an online literary site. And it scares the heck out of me, because I would much rather write a novel than a short story. I think a short story is a lot harder to write than a novel. I think people notice your mistakes in a short story.
Yeah, but yeah, it's so much more
400 pages.
When you talk about world building, a short story is a window where a novel can be a whole world if you want to look at it that way. But yeah, it's this very short arc in a short story, and you've got to have this great. And when we write short stories in class, in undergrad, we didn't know how to end them, so our main characters would just die. And this happened over, and by the third week, somebody's character died, like in a tragic blimp accident. Something like we're trying to, there are only so many ways you can, and the teacher's moratorium, no more characters dying, and so.
There are other questions?
Chris, you and I were about the same time, although I'm a little closer to my 35th than my 30th right now.
Yeah.
You reference your classmates and everything from class of 88 that you weave in and out of the thing here.
Yeah.
Do you find, how much of an influence do you have in the writing of faculty members and staff members that would have been at Woodbury when we were there? And I'm really thinking in my mind, how would Emmett Wright have handled this kid disappearing from campus? How, I can imagine just the assembly that we would have had after that and his
right.
presence there. Are the influences from outside of the students as significant as what you see from students you knew when we were there?
Most of the adult characters in the book that are at Blackburn are not really drawn on particular teachers. I deliberately tried to make, you know, the headmaster in the book and the assistant headmaster are very different from I didn't want to have a thinly veiled fictional version of Emmett Wright. If he'd been in there, he probably would have, you know, solved the, you know, would have been over by page chapter 2. And I go, well,
what notes did you get from your editor or from your beta readers that surprised you or that took things in a different direction?
My wife is my first reader and my first editor, and she's really good because she is completely honest. This is boring. Right? Real men and women don't talk to each other like this, Chris. This isn't. But let's see. My editors at Algonquin, Andra Miller, and Betsy Glick, were fantastic. People have often asked me, how dramatic is it when they ask you to change things? It says, you know, they think, as I'd say, it's not like they said, we really like the story, but we'd like you to do it but in space. Like, there's nothing, you know. What if you made it an all-girls school? Like, there was nothing ever like that. Most of the suggestions they made were, you don't need this scene. It's redundant. Or, I think the most surprising thing was Matthias, who's the main character, the protagonist, the narrator. My editor said, I think we need to make him a little more likable. Because he's a flawed character. He makes mistakes. the thing with him is he wants to do the right thing. He just doesn't always know how to do it, and sometimes he succumbs to something that's easier, and then later he feels regret. And everyone likes a story of redemption, so that's sort of what I'm trying to have here. But that was a surprise. Like, he can be a jerk, but he needs to be a little bit less of one, because you don't want readers to go, I don't care what happened. Maybe he should have vanished, right? I mean, I don't care. So that was surprising, but everything I got from my editors was, all of it was in service of story and in making the story work better, and I trusted them on that, and they were, it was much more collaboration than somebody on high saying, this is no good, change this. It's been wonderful. Algonquin's an outstanding, I'm not just saying this because I'm being recorded, or they didn't pay me for it, but they're excellent. The care they've given me and the interest they've shown in my work has been phenomenal.
Are you working on something new?
I am. It's fun. I got about 180 pages in, and then about 5 months ago, things started happening with this, so I'd have to stop. Sure. Could you write it? Could you take a look at this? So we have to do copy edits. And so it sort of started. So I just said, fine, I'm going to put that in the bag and focus on this. But soon after my school year starts, I'm going to get back to what my wife calls sacred writing time, from like 8 to 10 at night. The kids go to bed. I'm like, honey, what are you doing? Are you watching TV? She's like, right. Go right. Go upstairs. Right. Yes, ma'am.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I appreciate it. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special live recording of Inside the Writer's Studio, coming to you from the downtown Winston-Salem home of Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that sponsors not only this podcast, but also the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. You can find out more about the festival and all Bookmarks events and programs at www.bookmarksnc.org. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Christopher Swan, whose new novel, The Shadow of the Lions, is available wherever books are sold. And of course, you can get signed copies right here at Bookmarks. Join me next time on Inside the Writer's Studio with novelist Emily Collin, who will discuss her new novel, The Dreamkeeper's Daughter. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.